Summer is here. If the 90 degree days didn't tip it off, it also means school is out and parents are looking for fun things to do to keep those kiddos entertained. And if you're like me, I'm guessing you're asking some of these same questions. How do you make summer vacation fun in the middle of a pandemic? Everything from trips to playgrounds, team sports, play dates, it's all kind of underlined by this theme of what's safe and what's not. And I'm sure you've got your own questions about how to handle summer vacation with your kids. We're going to bring you two great guests to help answer those. So go ahead and jump on board. 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Dr. Rick Malley. He's a senior physician in pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Boston Children's Hospital and also a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Malley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Peter Gray. He's a research professor of psychology at Boston College, author of Free to Learn, and co-founder of Let Grow, a nonprofit that promotes child-led play. Peter, welcome back to you as well.
Very happy to be here.
So, Dr. Malley, I want to start with you and ask you kind of where kids fit into this pandemic. If we go back to when we first started learning about coronavirus, there was some concern that they'd be so-called super spreaders. Have we learned any more about the role kids play in spreading coronavirus?
I think we have, although there's still a lot to learn. At the outset of the pandemic, exactly as you said, most people really thought that this was going to follow the same pattern as other common respiratory viruses like the flu, where children are really, unfortunately, the main vectors of transmission. And so a lot of people were worried that that was going to be the case. But we had read reports from China that really indicated that children were somewhat more likely to resist the negative consequences of this infection and not get quite as sick. So that was the first puzzle. The second puzzle was that we found out from other countries like Iceland and Israel and other countries across the world that not only were children less likely to get sick, they were also less likely to even catch the virus in their nose and therefore less likely to spread it. Now, it isn't to say that they can't get sick from the virus. We certainly have, unfortunately, many examples of that. But they do seem to be more resistant to getting sick, and they also seem to be probably more resistant to serving as ping pong players to spread the virus across their families or other members of the community.
It's really interesting. I've got a son who will be 5 this summer, and so I can tell you firsthand, wearing masks, washing your hands, it all looks great on paper. That can be a real challenge, actually on the ground. Do you have kind of any general advice for parents in terms of how to keep your kids safe as we're starting to enter the summer months?
Yeah, it's a very interesting and important question you're asking. I think we all recognize that our dream of running around in the park or on the beach with our kids did not involve them wearing masks and staying 6 feet away from other children or other people, even that you know and are friendly with. But I do think that we have to take a certain amount of precautions because even though children are less likely to get sick and less likely to transmit, probably, they still can get sick and they can still probably spread the virus. And therefore, the recommendations we make is to, if the child is old enough, like your children, old enough to understand what we're trying to do, to explain to them that you can have fun, you can be outside. In fact, we want you to be outside. But we want you to follow a few rules that did not exist until 6 months ago. And those are the rules of staying a little bit away from people who are not directly in your family unit or in your social bubble. And also, when and if the child is willing, to wear a mask so that they do not infect others. And I think that's a very empowering statement you can make to a child to say that the reason they're wearing masks is to make sure that they're keeping all the other people safe as well.
It's a great way to look at it. Peter, I want to bring you in here, and we are going to open this up to some listener calls and questions as well. 1-800-423-8255 if you want to join the conversation. Peter, I mentioned in your intro you've spent your career researching play. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of play in a child's development, and what have you seen in the last few months during the pandemic?
Play is crucial to children's development, and much of my research shows that over the last few decades, our children have been very play deprived. They spend so much time in school, so much time at homework after school, so much time in adult-directed activities, which are not fully play. Play is activity that children develop themselves, that children take control of themselves, that where children learn to be independent and solve their own problems. So I've done a lot of research that shows that as we deprive children more and more of free play, we get more anxious, more depressed, less resilient children. We have huge increases in childhood suicide over the last several decades, and which of course is just the tip of the iceberg. What my research suggests is because children are so often in stressful, competitive kinds of activities, such as school, and have so little time to just really be children, to play. So what's interesting right now is all these things that have kept children so busy have been shut off. And what are the consequences of that? Well, the Let Grow nonprofit, which I'm a part of, has recently completed a major survey of families across the country. We've surveyed 800 families, pretty well balanced for socioeconomic group, geographic placement, and so on. These are all families that have children between the age of 8 and 13. And we asked a lot of questions about how the parents are coping. There were questions directed to the parents and questions directed to the target child within the family. Let me just give you a little bit of the data. I mean, the data were surprising even to me, and I think they will be even more surprising to others. So one of the questions was to the children was, are you more calm now or less calm than you were when you were before the school closures? 49%
I know how I'd answer that.
Said more calm. 25% said less calm, and the rest said about the same. We asked the parents the same question. 43% said they are now less stressed. 29% said more stressed. The others said no difference. Now, here's something that, you know, you introduced this by saying, how do we keep kids entertained? The interesting thing that parents are learning is they don't have to entertain their kids. Kids are pretty darn good at finding ways to entertain themselves. It took a while in some cases. They were bored, you know, but boredom is a good thing. They figured out what to do. So we got responses from the kids saying things like, you know, I've owned a guitar for 2 years and I've never had time to learn to play it. I have learned to play the guitar. I've been watching YouTubes and playing the guitar. We've heard from many kids who are riding bicycles for the first time. Imagine that. We're growing a generation of kids who aren't learning to ride bicycles because they're kept so busy, and also because we're so afraid they'll get hurt out there on the bicycle. Well, the traffic slowed down for a while. Kids didn't have much else to do. This is a safe way to get out and play. So, you know, I've heard from parents who say, I can't buy a bicycle. There's a run on bicycles, you know, so there's an interesting phenomenon here. I don't want to say this.
It
is
interesting.
Obviously
there's a lot.
Obviously. Yeah. And obviously there are families suffering. Obviously we probably didn't hear from the families that, you know, that just hate one another within the family. You don't want to be stuck at home there. We probably heard from the families who are coping a little better than some of the other families. But what's really interesting is these parents are saying, I am impressed by my children. They are more responsible. They're taking more control of themselves. Many of them are doing homework. They're asked housework.
It is interesting.
Housework that I didn't think they were capable of doing.
It is interesting that I'm struck by a lot of what you're talking about. Obviously sounds great, but there is a privilege component here too, right? Not everybody can go out and buy a bike or has space in a backyard for kids to play, or you know, maybe parents who are frontline workers who are still having to go into the office and they're trying to figure out childcare situations. How are you thinking about that as you're processing the data?
Well, I think that's a very, very good point. And it's hard to know. But what I can tell you is that the problem that existed before this pandemic is across social class. It's across race. Children have been suffering because of deprivation of play. And the primary reason for the deprivation of play is not having time to do it. And because we're living in a world where people feel that it's unsafe for children to go outdoors, we've exaggerated the dangers. And this is across social class. There was a time a couple of decades ago when this was more common in the so-called more privileged classes. They were more overprotective of their children than people who are economically less privileged. Now this is across social class, partly because people are afraid they'll be arrested if they send their children out to play.
That's a can of worms that we could get into another time. I do want to make sure we get some calls in here, so let's go to the phones. Cebu in Sudbury is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Cebu.
Thanks for having me. My question in this context kind of maybe, and I'm hearing all the benefits, and I think I agree with some of those things that are intrinsically happening with trying to expand ways that children are staying busy. My comment would be, you know, I'm a very personable person, and I like to think my son is 4 and a half, is also developing to be the same way. How do you start to explain some more of the uncertainty around just running into folks, say, in public areas where, you know, you are trying to get outside? That's kind of my first question. And my second question is in terms of how do you keep your, so more the flip side of that, your private circle, how do you sort of ensure that folks are taking it seriously, you know, the virus seriously, and being able to interact with them both indoors and outdoors, right? Because summer will come to an end. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. Dr. Malley, let me bring you in on this because I think socialization obviously has a number of benefits, but how do you balance that with the health concerns?
Yeah, it's a challenge we've all been facing. I think it's helpful to remember that even though we can't put a number to the risk that is associated with, for example, crossing somebody in the hallway or on the elevator or even in a park, just running into somebody and sort of even bumping into them and then moving away, it just doesn't seem likely that represents a huge risk of transmission. And therefore, when one tries to explain to children, depending on their age, of course, what should or should not be done, I think it can be done in a way where you're trying to explain to the child that it's important to reduce those interactions, to limit that type of, close contact, if you will, with somebody that is not part of their family or their social bubble, but without giving them this fear, this anxiety that all of a sudden they've entered some sort of radioactive zone when they're in the face of someone that they don't know. I think that really can help quite a bit to reduce the anxiety and the frustration that people might have. I do think it's absolutely critically important that we take advantage of good weather, that we bring kids outside, that we re-engage in the type of activities that make our kids healthier and happier. Without creating the sense that just because you're temporarily and very briefly closer to someone than maybe you and I would like for our child, that is going to represent a significant risk.
Yeah. I want to go back to the phones at 1-800-423-8255. Danny in Cambridge, you're up next. Welcome to the show, Danny. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. A question for your guest. I have a 27-month-old. And forget about the fact that I can't get this kid to put on a mask to save my life. He hates when I wear my mask. It really bothers him. And my question is...
Oh, Danny, you're speaking my language. I got an 18-month-old that's doing the same thing. Cries as soon as it goes on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's awful. And, you know, daycares are opening back up. Our daycare center is opening back up at the end of July. And I think the thing that concerns me is that I know that developmentally, small children are really reliant on facial expressions. And what scares me is, you know, what is this going to affect our children developmentally when they go back to daycare and, you know, their teachers all have face masks on? You know, how are they going to be able to read their expressions, to connect with them, to form those deep bonds and those connections that will affect them for the rest of their life? Is this something that... I mean, is this something that we really need to be concerned about? And if so, how do we mitigate that? How do we rectify that at home?
Yeah, great question, Danny. I'll throw that up to either of you, Rick Malley, Peter Gray, whoever wants to
I
jump on
have
that.
one thought to that, which may surprise some people. You know, you can see facial expressions on Zoom or on the computer. So one possibility is, even with little kids, let them interact with their friends and other people over the computer. At least it's not perfect. It doesn't take the place of physical hugs and jostling and all of that. But at least it's if you're concerned about losing the opportunity to respond to physical expressions, you know. Of course, during this time, we've all been on Zoom a heck of a lot more than we ever were before. And I think what everybody's finding is when you're looking at one another. It's certainly better than being on the telephone. You're interacting.
Let's go back to the phones here. Ravit in Cambridge, you're up next. Ravit, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Dr. Malley. You mentioned a social bubble, and I was wondering how many families do you recommend to connect together to form that bubble?
It's a great question. Dr. Malley, what do you say?
Yeah, I think like anything, it's a matter of knowing your friends and the members of your bubble. In other words, if you said to me, I have two families that I'm very close to and they have kids and we have all pledged to really only see one another and nobody else. And that could amount, if they each have a couple kids, you have a couple kids, that could amount to like a pretty big group of people. But as long as everybody is respectful of that contract to the extent possible, then I think that's not an unsafe situation. What you don't want is a situation where, for example, your friends are part of six different social bubbles, sort of jumping around from one group to another and another, because then unfortunately the whole contract is basically void as far as I'm concerned. And so more than the number of families that you're willing to include, I would consider using your own judgment of how much risk you're willing to take for yourself and for your families. For example, you know, restaurants are now open indoors, open outdoors. Personally, I think that it's very rational to try to decide for yourself whether you feel more comfortable with people who are going to be, for example, eating outdoors at the restaurant rather than going inside. And that might be a way to judge whether people in your bubble are respecting that same degree of risk that you're taking on for your own family. And that might help you decide. Go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna tag another on. We don't have time for any more calls, but Karen in Carlisle was gonna ask about her 15-year-old and whether they should be babysitting small kids. I'd imagine your advice is something similar lines. Understand the families you'd be working with and how they're approaching the situation.
Absolutely, yes. I think you're absolutely right. It's good to get that information. These days, fortunately, it will not be viewed as being intrusive to ask people how they are managing the pandemic. Actually, it's a very interesting conversation. And I think, you know, people learn from one another that way, what works, what doesn't, what makes them feel comfortable. And I think if somebody wants to have a job such as babysitting, it would be very important to understand what the other family is doing.
Yeah, that's Dr. Rick Malley, senior physician in pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Boston Children's Hospital and a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Malley, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure.
And also with us is Peter Gray, research professor of psychology at Boston College, author of Free to Learn and co-founder of Let Grow, a nonprofit that promotes child-led play. Peter, thanks so much for your time, too.
Thank you for having me on.